Welcome to the Klamath Tribes Podcast. Today, Garen Riddle is joining me, the interim director of the Culture and Heritage Center for the Klamath Tribes. He's always present at ceremonies, public events, very insightful on the history and culture of the Klamath Tribes. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we have a big ceremony this Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. It's the 36th anniversary annual TROM ceremony.
That is correct.
So 36 years they've been doing this. Well, how did it begin?
Well, I do believe, according to our sacred narratives, that it began a long time ago in the time of what we would call the Posadawas time. The Posadawas time was a time that animals and different humanoid people would communicate with each other. That this was a time before all mukluks were created. This was a time that that when we say time immemorial, we're talking about that time. As far back as the common knowledge, I mean, of anything really, even older than, you know, some of the rocks and stuff, it goes back to that time. And at that time, Kamukamch had built a dome-shaped mat house at a place that we call Gomekski. It's a cave place down on the Sprague River. And at that time, he gave instructions, and these instructions were that we had to capture a chwam when it came up. The very first one that was coming up, we would capture that one, and we would cremate it into the fire and turn it to ashes. And as long as these instructions were taken and followed through, we were told that the fish will be plentiful forever. But we were also warned, and the warning was is that if we don't do these ceremonies and we don't do the honoring of that fish every year, that those fish will eventually go away. Now, that is tied to who we are, because at one time that fish fed our people and sustained us throughout a very, very hard, long winter, and we would have starved without that fish. So the other part of that that story goes that if that fish goes away, the mukluks go away too. So this is something that we take very seriously. There isn't any other instructions that I have heard of that came directly from our creator, Kamukamch. And these are instructions that came from him. So we take this very seriously, cultural practitioners, as well as other people that are just doing their best to follow the traditional ways. We look at this like it's a mandate almost. You know, we have a responsibility, and there are several people in our tribe throughout the years, you know, thank God for them, because if they wouldn't have kept these things going, then myself wouldn't know about these things as well. So I'm just trying to do my best to follow through with some of the instructions that I've been given and my responsibilities, and following in the footsteps of our ancestors that came before us. To my knowledge, the last traditional TROM ceremony happened in 1932 or 34. I can't remember the exact date. And that was done by Captain Sky. Captain Sky at that time was ridiculed. There was people down there that were saying not very nice things to him, saying things such as, you know, we don't need that fish anymore. That's a bottom feeder fish. You know, we have cows and we have beef and we have all these other new things, and we don't need those foods anymore. And so at that time, the people that were documenting that were supposed to be documenting the procedural things that were going on at the TROM ceremony about the actual ceremony. But what they ended up capturing was the ugliness of some of the people that were down there. And it is said that some of those people might have been intoxicated at that time, but due to the way that he was treated at that time, he said that he wouldn't do the TROM ceremony anymore unless the people wanted him to. And so it wasn't done for a very long time, up until 1988, when our elders and our elders committee and several other elders spoke up about the importance of wanting to bring that ceremony back. So it was done again for the first time since Captain Sky had done it in 1988.
Did you attend it as a child?
Negative. I was 6 years old at that time. But no, I did not have the ability or the memory of being able to attend that one.
Because children do attend.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very encouraged that our children come, that our elders come. People come with an open heart and a prayer, you know. And the prayer is for our TROM. But ultimately, The prayer for the Tuam is a prayer for all the species out there, as well as our Muklucks, because we're all connected.
Is this a Klamath ceremony first and foremost, or Yahooskin, or Modoc?
Well, at the spot that we're doing it at, it is more closely related to the Klamath. The spot that they used to actually do the ceremony at was about a mile south of where they say Bray Mill was, at Wolkstat. And Wolkstat is up for debate, I guess, through some of our cultural practitioners, whether it's right there at Bray Mill or if it's south of Bray Mill, which is indicated in some of the things that I've read, at Wolkstat, the village site that's about a mile south of where the cave is now. So that's where the ceremony was traditionally held. Also by Captain Sky, he did the ceremony there. Being that we don't really have too much access down there and we was wanting to provide a location to continue doing that, the site was chosen down by the high school, where we do it now at the old dam site. And that is not the original location. So there's been talks about trying to move it back to the original location. But some of those things just haven't come to fruition yet. So I would say, to answer your question, yes, this is more of a Klamath inspired ceremony. But there's other sites where I was told that the Modocs would do a sucker ceremony or a first fish ceremony. And I believe that those sites were down by the Olean Gap. And on both sides of the gap, there was fishing and there was scaffolds to be able to air dry their fish. And there was huge village sites on both sides. One side was Modocs, and I was told the other side was Klamaths. And they would congregate there and have ceremony and have foot races. And when horses came, horse races and lots of gambling and a lot of ceremonial things that brought our people together at those times.
So the ceremony Saturday starts at 10 a.m.?
Yes, it'll officially start roughly around 10 a.m. Try not to put time frames and time limits on ceremonies because it's supposed to be the will of the spirit and the heart that is there, not necessarily stuck at a time, but to try to do our best for coordinating, yes, it is supposed to start promptly at 10 a.m. We'll have ceremony there, and that will be followed by a lunch at Gosol Gigawa. That is at 35601 Chokecherry Way. After lunch, we will be having an honoring of our elders. And so there was six elders that were chosen. And these elders are people that have been significant people in our tribe, significant people in our communities, and significant people just all around in their families. And so we wanted to honor some of those elders by presenting them. One of the gifts that we have in Indian country is to wrap those people with the Pendleton blanket and tell them thank you for everything that they've done. And that Pendleton blanket represents several different things. I was told when conducting funeral services, I like to buy blankets for the children and wrap them up and remind them that, you know, the people that they love that have gone away, they might not be able to hug them no more, but if you close your eyes and you can picture them, you can wrap yourself up in that blanket and feel the security and safety of the people that maybe have gone on before us. You know, so we have that same thought for our elders. You know, the elders and the children are so much alike. You know, we were born into diapers and then we go out into diapers. We both don't have any teeth. They both love sweet things. And so there's a lot in common. And so to wrap our elders up with that safety and security and let them know that they're loved and they're appreciated is something very, very close to our traditional values. And so we like to proceed forward like that.
And there's a lunch?
Yes, there is a lunch. We'll be having traditional foods there. If anybody would like to contribute, our cook this year is Candy Uzazero. She cooked for us last year as well, and she's a very popular cook around Indian country around these ways. She is very personable. She does a very, very good job at taking care of any of the foods. And she has a good spirit. You know, part of the reason that people are chosen for these things is because of part of their energy and their spirit goes into the dishes that they prepare. And then we as Muklucks are, you know, the people will consume that and take in a good part of that meal that was prepared by that person.
Traditional foods. I was at it last year. I think they had salmon. And what are they having this year?
This year, I think the menu is going to pretty much depend on who wants to donate or who wants to be able to supply some foods for that. So last year, I believe that we had some some kames, some epas, some ges, which are all foods that you would, you know, gather in this in the fall time or the summertime. And there was deer meat, elk meat, salmon. We had some yen. So the close relatives of our Chuam and Koptu are yen. We were able to put that back into our bodies last year. And I think for many people, that was the first time they were able to partake in that spiritual food. And that's something very important to us too. I don't think we're going to be having suckers this year to be able to partake in and to share, just because the numbers have declined so much. As a matter of fact, as a committee for the Chuam ceremony this year, we were right on the verge of postponing it and pushing it back. And the only reason that would be is because we didn't have any Chuam to even do our ceremony. And through those talks, it came apparent through everybody that was talking that would be a good idea to be able to postpone it, because how are you to have a Chuam ceremony with no Chuam? Luckily, you know, through the prayers and the good thoughts and the hard work through Umbo Dot, James Escueda is very, very instrumental in a lot of the things that we're doing right now as far as the Chuam and their restoration and the heart for them. He was able to go out and talk to some of the team, and we were able to get two fish for our Chuam ceremony, so it didn't have to be postponed. But that is one of the things that I think people need to be aware of, is that this fish has been on the endangered species list for a very long time now. And a lot of the work that we've done, a lot of the hatcheries and stuff that were created to help the populations and the rearing of these fish, I don't know, have been as successful as I thought we would have hoped. Now, the fact that we can't get Chuam for a Chuam ceremony at the time in which we're supposed to do the Chuam ceremony is very concerning to me. It's not just about being able to pray for these fish. It's really about boots on the ground, and we need to start restoring all the areas around the lake, all the areas in which after these Chuam hatch and then they go from the rivers back into the lake, they have to have habitat. And if there's no habitat for them to return to, then they're just snacks for everybody else. And so we really have to get boots on the ground and start doing this restoration work around the lake and around these riparian areas that really allow these fish to thrive and grow in safety and security.
Yeah, and the history of the fish, it was plentiful.
Absolutely.
And this isn't something a long time ago. It was plentiful in the early 80s, correct? Or late 70s. I mean, there was a drop-off at one point in the last few decades, but it was plentiful.
Absolutely, yeah. There's stories from some of our elders talking about you could walk on the backs of them across the rivers. That's how plentiful they were. I've also read different things about when the dam was up. There was several elders that had given us stories about the way that the rivers were, about the abundance of fish. And one of the stories said that the fish were so plentiful that they were backed up, banging their heads against the dam that we're going to be having the Chuam ceremony at, but they were backed up all the way to Highway 97. It was such a big block, just with the amount of fish going through. And they said on their lunch break, they went over there to the dam site and they had to kick the eagles in the booty to get them out of the way. That way they could get to the river because there were so many bald eagles just feasting on these fish. That's how abundant they were at that time.
What time is this?
I'm going to say in the 60s.
Are we talking about which dam?
The dam right behind the high school that it just came out.
Oh, yeah. Up here in Chiloquin.
In Chiloquin, yes. So it's a vast contrast to what it used to be to what it is now. They used to be very, very plentiful. But at the same time, 114 years ago, our salmon was plentiful too. But the construction of these dams, the way that we replumb these streams and divert water and poison the water, take all the willows and all the other stuff that's supposed to be right next to the rivers, we take those out. And what happens is that the water just runs directly into the streams. It heats up. There's phosphorus. There's all kinds of different things that are going on as we continue to, you know, go through with time. And we just have to start doing some restoration to these different areas along with our prayers. Because these fish were one of the most abundant resources that we have. Without these fish, we probably wouldn't be here today. So,
got you through the winter.
Absolutely. Yeah, the fish was the very first fish that would run up the system. And so we would have people sitting by the rivers waiting for these fish to come up, and then they would report back, you know, that these fish are running. And we would have our Chuam ceremony, and then we would have the ability to be able to fish those fish after that. But the way that I was taught is that nobody would fish those Chuam until the ceremony happened to be able to honor the rules that were given to us by Kamukamch. And after that, we would be able to go and fish those fish.
How did you fish them? How was it nets or spears? I mean, you know, how did they get them? So many of them, right? You don't just go after one when they're that thick in the river.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of different ways. We would have almost like gaffing hooks to be able to stab them and pull them out. There was nets that were made, and some of these nets were made out of dog bane. Some of our traditional hemp that we have here, it's a relative of, what the heck's that? It's the plant that is very helpful for our monarch butterflies. I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's made out of this fibrous material, and we would make nets out of it, as well as our Numu relatives, our Paiute relatives would use that same material to make rabbit nets. But they were netted. We had hooks that we would put on, and we would catch them that way. And then we also had this beautiful way of being able to reconstruct inside the rivers these different places where it would channelize them, almost like our own dams, kind of.
Yeah, they use rocks and boulders, right, to divert the water.
Absolutely, yeah. We would divert the water, and then we would
A little pond that was created, and they're right there to scoop up.
Absolutely.
I wonder if they use the baskets, too, like the woven baskets that, you know, the Klamath are famous for.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of those baskets and stuff, as far as the winnowing mats, were used for other plant foods. But there is stuff that I've read about drying the fish out and pulverizing it and making these different cakes out of them. And those cakes would be made out of all kinds of different foods. You could put huckleberries in there. You could put camas or wokus, and you would mix different things. And I think I've heard them called pinch cakes before.
Mm, sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds healthy too.
Absolutely. We would also take meat and then add some fat to it. And it would almost be like this nutritious meat, like on the go bar, you know?
So what's a Chuam taste like?
A Chuam is a white meated fish, and I can't really describe the flavor of it, because I know what a salmon tastes like, I know what a trout tastes like, and it doesn't taste like that. It has a very good succulent kind of meat to it, and pretty
oily.
It's a little bit oily.
Not too much though.
No, it's satisfying. It's a wonderful fish to eat, and I think whatever you put on it, like I put in lime and dill on it before, and it was really good. It kind of takes on the flavors in which you want to throw on there, but it is one of my favorite fishes.
Yeah, you know, like you were saying that when
Captain Sky
had that ceremony, and they were saying it's this bottom dwelling. Why would they say that back then when they know it's a good tasting fish that has historically sustained them? And if you have had one, I had the yen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good.
Yes.
I mean, it was my first time to taste that fish. And I was like, wow, this is really nice. I don't know how you could say that's not a good fish if it, when you've tasted it.
Well, I think at that time there was a huge push for being able to move forward with the colonization that was being forced upon all of our people at that time. And if you were going to stick to the old traditional ways and try to make a living that way, it was kind of demonized. It was looked down upon. There's several different people at that time that we're trying to keep the old ways alive, and it was just the vast majority of our people had already kind of converted in that way to being able to adopt a lot of the different colonization beliefs and thoughts. And so when he was down there performing that ceremony, I am assuming here, which I probably shouldn't do, but I'm assuming that people went down there with that colonization kind of mind, as well as having the spirit of alcohol in there.
Mm.
And so those combinations can be very hurtful sometimes. And I imagine that his feelings were hurt, and that's why he chose not to do it again. You know, Lee Snipes was one of our very last Kiyuks that I know of. And I find all kinds of pictures of him. I don't find too much written about him, but I've seen several different papers that he had signed, you know, with the talks with Boyd Jackson and some of those old papers. I had seen some documents where his signature's on there, so...
Yeah, the demise of the fish in the large lake we have here is the canary in the mine. of what's wrong with the ecosystem. If you had this fish that was so plentiful and abundant disappear, it's the tell-all to the unhealthiness of the lake.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a huge tell-all. And there's several different things that go into how we ended up getting to where we are now. And one of the problems that we have is, you know, fish that were stocked into our lake, you know, like the sturgeon. And those sturgeon are huge fish that devour basically the same diet that our chwam would devour. So it doesn't leave much food for them.
That was a stocked fish?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they restocked them several times, those sturgeon.
Huh. And they're still there?
They're still there. Yeah, there was one probably about 10, 15 years ago that was stuck in the A canal and they had to get it out with a huge crane. It was a huge fish.
Like how big?
800 pounds.
Oh, 800 pounds.
That was a big fish.
My God, I didn't know they get that big.
Yeah, they get really big.
So we should go out and catch them, right? Get them out of there and eat them.
Well, we could. I don't know exactly what the rules are for the sturgeon fish.
They're an invasive species.
Absolutely.
Go get them. Catch them. Man, can you imagine pulling out an 800-pound sturgeon?
I couldn't. I'd need a crane or something.
That's
like
insane.
That.
That's insane. That's how much food they eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they eat a lot, and their diet is very similar to what the chwam is. And so, you know, that invasive fish, you know, is eating a lot of what nutritional value that is out there for our chwam, our kopdo, our testes, and our yen.
I don't know. Maybe we can be somewhat optimistic. I mean, we've got hatcheries now that are being aggressive and getting chwam and kopdo raised, reintroduced. But first, we got to clean it up the lake, like you were saying. There is restoration work going on. I don't know. Some people say it's too late. I don't think it's too late. As long as we got the fish in the ponds being reared and we're working on the ecosystem, give the ecosystem time to heal, the fish will come back.
I believe that to be true. I think we do rely too much on our hatcheries. It was supposed to be a backup plan, you know, to help rear fish and to get more fish into the system. But ultimately, we need to provide some help for the ecosystem. We really have to get out there and start doing work in some of these areas that is vital for our fish's survival. And there's been lots of work done by our UMBO department up in the north reaches, you know, all over in Saikan Marsh area, all the way down into our system. And they did excellent work. I've seen a lot of good things come out of that department. But we still need to do a lot of work around the lake because ultimately that's the habitat in which these adolescent fish have to be able to grow up in those conditions there. The hatchery fish are supplementing some of the fact that a lot of our fish are not reproducing. However, it's a genetically modified fish. You know, it's raised in this controlled condition and then you put them out into the wild and they're like brand new again, you know, even if they're raised to a larger size. But I really appreciate what the hatcheries are doing and how hard they're working. But we really have to get boots on the ground out there in the actual ecosystem and do some work. And that's going to take the fact that it's about the fish and it's about our future generations. Principles before personalities, I'll say. You know, because sometimes we get hung up on different things. Just working with other people that we might not want to work with, but ultimately it doesn't matter because it's not about them. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about these fish.
This the chwam ceremony Saturday, since this is going to be heard by non-tribal members too, but is this strictly a tribal member event?
No, this is not strictly a tribal member event. I would like to see as many of our people as possible to be able to be there and to pray and to come together, you know, because it's really about community. But other people are welcomed there. We've always treated our guests the best way that we possibly can. We will feed them. We will treat them in a good way. After the honoring of the elders, which will take place right around 1 o'clock, we will also be having a language or a naming ceremony done by the language department. Georgine Nelson is working on that, and she'll be giving these tribal names away to people that would like a name. And I believe that was started towards the beginning of, I think, the 90s. There was people that were really wanting a traditional name, and so it was passed on down to our elders, and our elders decided that that would be a good, appropriate place to be able to give people their names. Then after the naming ceremony, we'll move right into stick games. Joe Mike from our community service department is going to be leading us in that. And I felt like that was something that was needed at our CHWAM ceremony, just for the simple fact that everything that I know about our people, we always had celebrations, whether it was a Wokus feast or a Huckleberry feast or a CHWAM feast or ceremony. We would always have games. We would have foot races. We would have horse races. We would have these different games. And stick games are one of those games that we would play.
So that is this Saturday, the CHWAM ceremony starting at 10 a.m. This is March 29th, if you're listening. We'll have it up today, the podcast. And the location exactly?
The location will be behind the high school. You go down
Chiloquin
that road
high
there,
school.
Chiloquin High School. You go down that road. It's behind that yellow gate that's usually locked. And you just follow that road down until you see the fire. And there'll be people down there. We'll have chairs down there.
Yeah, it's a narrow dirt road. It's not too long, right to the river. So if you want to park in the high school parking lot, I suppose that's an option. If somebody, if this draws a lot more people than last year. Last year was a moderate amount of people. Not too many, not, you know, but I could see it getting crowded there if we double that amount.
Absolutely, yeah. We encourage you to park at the high school and the junior high and walk on down. We don't want to clog the road there just because elders might be needing support getting up and down the road. And people that need to come and go, they'll be given access to go down there. But if elders need to go all the way down there to be dropped off, we'll try to do our best to facilitate some of those things or give them rides down there.
Excellent. Garen Riddle, Interim Director of the Culture and Heritage Center. Are we going to stay in that position for a while?
I'm going to do what my people ask me to do. This isn't something that I asked for. This is something that some of the people that are older than me and wiser than me asked me to step up and to fulfill this responsibility. And so I'm doing my best to fulfill those responsibilities as my elders and my people ask me to.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for joining me today to talk about the CHWAM ceremony, the 36th year of this ceremony, and many more to come.
Many, many more to come.
You've been listening to the Klamath Tribes podcast. Have a good day.